Hey everyone, sorry it's been a few weeks since I posted any videos or any content. I've been hard at work on a new zine. It's on the topic of depth psychology, focusing on the work of Carl Jung and Stanislav Grof, who are the two foremost psychological researchers and pioneers of the 20th century. Stan Grof is still alive. He's 80 or 90, but he's a super underrated but very significant and pioneering figure in 20th century science, particularly as it comes to the study of human consciousness. So I have a new zine that's dedicated to their work, overviewing it. There's lots of content from Manly Hall as well. The focus is on the mystical experience and the sort of psychology of mysticism, but it also goes into something very timely, which is, first it overviews astrology, and then it goes into the astrology of 2020 and gives a summary of the three major planetary conjunctions that happened in 2020, going into 2021. And finally, it does a case study on the Pluto-Saturn conjunction in particular, and some of the main themes of the Pluto-Saturn conjunction, which happened in January 2020, but extends because of this orb situation, which is like when it comes into a certain area that's not... It went exact in January 2020, but it's in the field of influence throughout from 2019 to stretching to right about now in November 2021. And when you look at the themes, and I'm going to be doing a whole episode on this, probably more than one, but when you look at the themes of prior Pluto-Saturn conjunctions, or not just the conjunctions, but the squares and the oppositions, the so-called hard aspects between these two planets, you won't believe the theme. The prior events in history that align with them, but also the dominant psychological themes that are associated with them. And so when we look at what's happening in the world in terms of people's psychological reaction to events and the sort of very polarized situation that we find throughout the Western world about how to respond to this crisis, the global health crisis and the government response and the totalitarianism and the just the social polarization, it's unbelievably on theme to Saturn Pluto. And a significant part of part of the zine is going to the relationship between astrology and psychology and explaining the relationship between the two and why there's an influence. So this is a really great publication. I'm super happy with it. I just last night finished editing it and sent it off to get my first batch of hard copies back from the printers. But same with the last zine, I'm going to have digital PDFs available. I'm going to have hard copies available. And I also have a custom shirt that features Stanislav Grof and Carl Jung. I actually designed it a year ago in anticipation of putting out this project together, but it took me a whole year to finally get around to putting that zine out. But it's super timely. It's got a lot of beautiful descriptions of the mystical experience. It overviews the sort of essential features of Carl Jung's model of psychology, his approach to the psyche. So it goes over his main themes. It also goes over the main trajectory of Stanislav Grof's work. He focused on a type of experience, psychological experience that human beings can have called holotropic experiences. More commonly, people might call them the mystical experience or spiritual experiences. But these are experience of transpersonal states of consciousness where you're confronted by archetypal themes and beings and forces. If you've ever done DMT or had a strong hallucinogenic experience, you might have encountered something like this state. I mean, his career started off focusing on in the 50s on early clinical research with LSD as a means of exploring these type of psychological states, and then later in his career he would develop non-drug based approaches, taking a lot of a lot of inspiration from shamanistic and sort of primitive cultures, how they would ritualistically engender non-ordinary states of consciousness. So these themes are all explored in the zine. It's 52 pages. It's a lot like my other zine. It's 8.5 by 11, lots of illustrations done sort of in a magazine style. So it's very approachable, a ton of quotes. So it's, you know, I'm writing some of it, but a lot of it is me compiling and organizing quotes. So you'll get it right from the main figures. I also feature a lot the work of Richard Tarnas, who is a colleague of Stanislav Grof's, who specializes more in the relationship between psychology and astrology. So in a couple weeks, early December, I should have copies of that available. And I have a whole ton of basically all the content I'm going to do on my channel for December is going to be based around that. And in the meantime, I'm going to kick off working on the next zine, next study guide after that, which is going to be on the topic of Manly Hall's teachings on the esoteric philosophy of health and just how the human system is organized. And then I'm going to do a case study on epidemics. I'm going to have a good bit of information on the research I've done about the fundamental flaws in the virologist worldview. And I'm going to discuss just scientific materialism in general, which is something I get into in this scene a little bit as well. But definitely one of my goals in this channel is to take focus at scientific materialism and the sort of larger sort of like cult-like ideology of materialism that is so rampant in our culture. And so, and I feel, which is very much responsible for a lot of the confusion and the sort of antisocial policies and behaviors that are going on in the world today. And so on this theme, in today's video, I want to discuss, just before I do all this stuff with the new zine that I have coming out, I want to do another bit on this Atlantis zine. And I want to particularly discuss the concept of race as it is taught in esoteric philosophy. So the meaning of race in esoteric philosophy. And race is something that is very much in the news and in the culture and in the zeitgeist today, because it is being the idea of being obsessed with race and being sort of resentful of race and sort of trying to drag everybody back into a mid-20th century mindset in terms of race is something that we see all over the culture now. It's sort of, in a lot of ways, tied to the protests and the events of 2020, certainly the riots. The Rittenhouse trial just happened this past week that I'm recording this video, and that has been made into this big spectacle where this sort of racial angle has been forced onto the situation, which I think is completely inappropriate considering what the facts of the case are. I've been following it, and the way it's been portrayed in a lot of the popular media and sort of online, and people's opinions are so detached from reality. I just don't understand why people are making this about a racial thing. But this idea of race. And we also have the critical race theory. I live in Virginia. So last month we had an election here for the governor, and a big part of the issue was this idea of certain racial concepts which are being taught in the school systems, which are just very primitive in my view. And I think a big thrust of what we're seeing in terms of this obsession with race is that it gets people, number one, it polarizes people and gets them fighting together, sort of a classic divide and conquer type strategy. But it also keeps people from looking constructively about ways that we can come together in a sort of united front against the state, corporate, financial totalitarianism, the tech sort of technocracy totalitarianism that we're seeing sweeping the world, and that is very much at the forefront of these mass tracing, or what are they called, contact tracing apps, and the vaccine mandates, and the sort of like global surveillance system and all these things that we would all have a shared incentive in coming together and organizing against, or at least coming together as a united political front against, we're completely estranged from each other and all fighting together, fighting amongst each other, and just completely confused psychologically because of this sort of like, I think it's a deliberate manipulation campaign that's being foistered, one of many deliberate misinformation and sort of like socially antagonizing campaigns that are going on through the media. And so what I want to do in this video is revisit some of the themes from this Atlantis zine that talks about the concept of race and the origin of race and sub-races within esoteric philosophy. So this brings me to my first point. In esoteric philosophy, you always have a part-whole dynamic. So the human race is a whole, and that whole branches out or expresses itself in a tree-like pattern in which the one racial motion that we're all a part of, no matter what ethnicity you are, that one racial motion over the course of time and through circumstance and through the sort of needs of the soul, the world soul, which is expressing itself through humanity, that system branches out into differentiation and specialization. But even though different groups through the course of time became separated from each other with the idea that things began in a unified state before gradually moving into a diversified state, that underlying unified state never goes away. It never becomes divided. We never actually become many different races. The black race is not separate from the white race, so to speak, or the Asian race, or, you know, these racial concepts are not absolute. So the idea that the differences between different ethnicities are sub-races, they're parts within one whole, they're different branches of one tree. And that ultimately, that lesson right there, that teaching is the foundation for a sort of concept, an idealistic concept of human life that can bring people together by focusing on the fact that we are all parts within a whole, and we're not just separate individuals who are completely disassociated from each other, completely separate from each other, and that we always have been, and that there's these inherent differences. There are differences between people, and there are differences through the historical past of what we've been through, different peoples have been through, but to focus on those differences and not give any light or to not emphasize at all the underlying unity of the situation is completely dishonest. And that's why I think there's a campaign of misinformation, because none of this is based on like sound reasoning, and certainly none of it is constructive in terms of guiding people's thinking for the future. It's very much, let's focus on the past and all the divisiveness of the past, and let's keep, you know, fighting together. It'd be almost like, you know, like the Balkan states were to all of a sudden have this campaign of let's all focus on the slights, not even the slights, the war atrocities and all the stuff that happened 30 and 40 years ago at the expense of trying to establish and build a sort of country and a civilization towards the future. So let's deconstruct things back to antagonize people to getting into a mind state of civil war. So anyway, in esoteric philosophy, there's always this idea of part and the whole. And so let's look back at the very first origin of this. This is something that Manly Hall's gone through in several of his articles. He goes in depth in a few of them. If you look at the table of contents, that's on the... Well, it's not a table of contents. If you look at the works referenced section of the study guide, you'll notice, or I will point out that I think he talks about this primarily in the Atlantis and Origins of Civilization article, which is also what I titled the zine. But he has an article called Atlantis and the Origins of Civilization that you can find on manlyphall.info. I think he also goes into it in his lecture series, The Atlantean Hypothesis. But he, this idea of the, what, how the origins of races began. But let me just start off by saying the race concept proceeds by an archetype. Human race, it's evolutionary and involutionary, meaning its cycle into matter and its cycle out of matter, proceeds according to an archetype, which means that there's a pattern that's inbuilt within nature, the mind pattern of nature. And humanity is a creation, just like all of nature, all the different kingdoms of nature are a creation of this mind pattern. And so what that means is that the story of human history, human evolution, is not an arbitrary, a story of chance events happening. And that is what we're taught according to Darwinian evolution. But Malian Hall actually has a number of articles and lectures that, well, I think one of his lectures is called I Beg to Differ with Darwinian Evolution or something like that. But it's basically all the Darwinian approach is based on scientific materialism, the idea that things exist only in the material form. And so we need to try to explain the diversity of species and the complexity of life that we see today by purely a material explanation. Well, in esoteric philosophy, it's the exact opposite. It's not that the complexity of life builds upward through form, but actually the life, you know, so for example, the Big Bang is not a philosophically sound hypothesis. The Big Bang is in physics is one in which the universe starts as the smallest sort of hypothetical material point, and then expands outward and to finally becoming the universe of all these different individual material forms. In psychology, in philosophy, it's the exact opposite. It's that things begin in the unity of abstract space, and then gradually form crystallizes and differentiates, almost like like condensation. It crystallizes and comes in out of abstract space into place. So think about the difference between place and space. There's the idea there's a metaphysical dimension between a material object existing in a place, just like I'm existing in this room on Earth in Virginia. So that's a place. And then there's abstract space, which is this idea of the unified womb, the sort of like context within which all things are held. And that connecting the two are a series of chords, I guess you might say, or planes or dimensions by which the unity of space is connected to the individuality of each part that exists with as a place within space. I know I'm kind of getting caught up in some wordplay here, but if you can picture this threefold, this trinity, right? You have space on one end, you have place on the other end, so thesis, antithesis, and then the synthesis that unites the two is this concept of metaphysics, that you have these different dimensions and planes that gradually step down from abstract space, which is unified, into place, which is in the realm of individual objects and diversity and heterogeneity. And so metaphysics is a fundamentally essential point to philosophy, esoteric philosophy, and that itself, the system of metaphysics, explains how astrology works. Is that the planets in astrology are correlated with metaphysics. So each of the planets is not the planet manifesting the energy, but the planet is a symbol of a metaphysical dimension that does exist and has real influence on our lives here. And in fact, the idea is that the human being is not just a physical body, but in fact, we have a number of bodies that extend into metaphysical space. With at the apex, we're connected to the spirit, which is associated with the idea of unified abstract space. The whole thing is modeled according to a certain pattern, and the metaphysical structure and the physical structure are both organized by this idea of this universal mind, which is an aspect of the spiritual realm of unified space. And that everything is created within unified space, within the spirit, by means of this mind, this divine mind. And the divine mind is what holds the archetypal pattern of the whole program of creation that is to proceed. And that this creation exists cyclically, and it exists according to a plan and a program and a purpose. So archetypally, the metaphysical structure is associated with the idea of the septenary. So there's seven fundamental dimensions, and then the physical earthly dimension is the eighth. And the idea is that the seven dimensions of metaphysics are manifesting, are sort of taking in the one energy, the one life of the spirit, and gradually stepping it down. But they're, from our perspective, they're manifesting energy. They're taking in the energy and they're specializing it and directing it downward. And then the eighth sphere, the physical, the earthly dimension, the material form, is the receiver of those seven energies. So that dynamic right there is the basic archetypal pattern. And when it comes to the races, the evolution of race and the formation of races of the human species is something that follows this archetypal pattern of seven. So the idea, the teaching and philosophy is that there are seven races. And these correspond to this sevenfold pattern of metaphysics. And so the early races, like the Hyperborean and the Polarian races, as is taught in esoteric philosophy, the first two that came and went, like in some far, far prehistoric age, were primarily metaphysical and not physical. Their life cycle was played out in a metaphysical age. And by saying they, it's really ours, because the idea is that we all went through that. In order to be where we are now, we all went through that stage. That it's like school, that we gradually proceed through these seven races. So the human life wave is one thing, ultimately one unified consciousness that goes through these seven ages. And as it does so, it sort of splits apart and individualizes its experience into all these separate forms. But behind and within the 7 billion life forms, for example, that are here today, there's one consciousness, there's one selfhood behind all of us that is experiencing all of us. There's one spirit. So the spiritual apex of every human soul, the sort of spiritual consciousness that each person has at the apex of their existence is the same. It's the one consciousness. So the seven ages of man are expressing this archetype of seven. And as they proceed, they gradually go from the upper end of their existence goes from the upper end of the metaphysical dimensions of the world, down into the earthly dimensions. And then so that's called involution, that downward motion from spirit to matter. And then gradually there's an upward motion again, which is called evolution, in which those material forms, or the life within those material forms, the consciousness gradually reawakens into its conscious awareness of the spiritual world. And as it does so, it moves back, and the orientation of its life moves back towards the spirit. And so you have a cycle. And so at the end of our evolutionary ascent, we all become one again with the spirit, or in other words, the spirit becomes awakened to the reality of its own existence behind each of our lives. So the fundamental truth is the unified spirit, and the temporary relative truths are the fact that we are all living in a stage now where we appear, where the life of that spirit is caught up in the illusion of its own creation, which is this idea that we're all creations as individualized beings. In a way, we're all sort of meditations of this one God who is the creator of the world, who is experiencing its own evolution and growth and development through us. As we grow and evolve, it is growing and evolving through us. And in esoteric philosophy, the idea of becoming enlightened is the idea of you have this spiritual core to yourself awakened, and you become an active participant, but also you realize the truth that this is what's happening, that behind existence is a deliberate creation of one God consciousness. So as the races proceed and they go from 1, 2, 3, 4, and now we're in the fifth age, they go through a cycle where they become more and more material in their orientation, which culminates in the fourth age, which is the Atlantean age. And the Atlantean age is associated with a fall. So there was a high civilization, great accomplishments, but there was also the corruption of knowledge, and a fall into dark times as a result of that corruption of knowledge. And then ultimately you have a destruction of that whole pattern. And that is the fall of Atlantis. And remember, things are proceeding archetypally. It's not like things could have happened different. It's like that storyline, that experience of having done that, then sets the stage for everything that we're going through today. And in a lot of ways, I can look at what's happening in the world as being a sort of recapitulation of this Atlantean fall, but with the caveat that we're in a different age. We're not in the Atlantean age. So like, karmically, it seems that we're re-expressing some old patterns, but the destiny is different. So the archetype of the Atlantean age was to experience that fall. And I think the ultimate archetype of our age is to experience the redemption. But in order to do that, we need to be confronted again with the sort of karmic past of our former lives, remembering that all souls today were once Atlanteans. We once went through those experiences. And so now we're going to be going through a type of rehash of them, but in order that we can learn as a collective the lessons that must be learned, so we can proceed on to the next stage of our evolutionary ascent. So this is the background of races. There is one human race, and that one human race goes through this seven, as a unified thing, it goes through these seven ages as a cohort. And in the course of doing so, it occupies seven different forms. So each age is associated with its own type of human design. And each of those human designs is also associated with a unique pattern of environment. So the Atlantean age corresponded with a different environmental setup for how the Earth was constituted. So with the transition of ages, we get not only a new human design, but the idea that our current design, which is called the Aryan, which is an old Sanskrit term that goes back thousands of years, and that we're all modern humans are Aryans, no matter what your ethnicity is, that whole pattern is not only associated with a different human race, but it's also a different model of the human race, but also a different environmental pattern here on Earth, which is custom designed to give us a certain type of experience. So that's basically the template. So then how do we get the sub-races? So let me read a section of the zine here that talks about the migrations. So this is under the Lemuria section. He also talks about this migration kind of dynamic, this archetype, in the context of both Lemuria and Atlantis, but it's basically one thing that keeps playing itself out. And I think that by implication, then our current age is one in which, I mean, the Aryan age is one in which this archetype of how one becomes many is recapitulated. So I'm going to read some of this. So the title of the section is called The Lemurian Migrations. The story of how the Lemurians migrated out from their initial homeland to populate the world established the original archetype or core design pattern for how one source tribe splits up, migrates, and differentiates into the formation of many tribes. So again, the concept is the race begins as one tribe. And so the idea is that out of the previous race, let's say we're talking about the Aryans, our current age. The idea is that there was one tribe of Atlanteans that broke off, isolated themselves, and then that group has a transformation occur within them. which we can go into detail on. But that, as a result of that transformation, that group becomes the seed of what is to be the next race. So that's the source. That's what's meant by the source tribe. There's one. It's not. So there, it's not. It's a whole tribe that's involved. But the idea of how that group transforms is that it is sort of there's a spiritual guiding light, a guiding force, which in ancient Indian tradition is called the Manu. And the Manu comes and embodies itself within that tribe, not just within a person, but within the whole tribe itself. And over time, the tribe sort of becomes the, not only does it change the physical characteristics and inspires the new design of the human, but the human is never separate from its social group and its collective. And so it's the whole civilization pattern that changes, not just the physical mind body design of an individual. So the Manu embodies itself in order to change that individual mind-body design. But then that mind-body design also becomes enmeshed within a social and cultural matrix. And that also changes. So the Manu becomes embodied not only in the individual, but also within the institutions. So that's what the source tribe is. It's this carrier of the institutions. And it's also the people who comprise the tribe. They become the carrier of this new design, this new human design. So, and this is something I get into later in this book, in the zine. In the case of the Aryas, this happened with a group who separated from Atlantis, nested themselves in India, northern India, in the Tibet region. Manly Hall says this happened as long back as 1 million years ago, the original source, when the Manu embodied itself within this tribe, gradually transforms the mind-body system of this people. Gradually, the institutions of this people get come to express this new design pattern that the Manu intends. The Manu, think of the Manu as like a bodhisattva. Perhaps someone who is already evolved, a sort of aspect of the spiritual consciousness that comes into its own creation in order to guide it towards the next step. And then the Manu departs, and the tribe sort of learns to maintain this spiritual design pattern within itself. And part of that is the mystery, how it will embody the mystery tradition. And the mystery tradition is how the spiritual consciousness is awakened in the individual, which is the whole point of the evolution, is to have the reawakening of the spirit, the spiritual core of each person, which has become latent as that spiritual consciousness as a whole has moved into a material state. It sort of forgets its own unity, becomes obsessed with material individuality. But as it learns to reawaken itself from its own dream, that happens through the institution of the mysteries. And so, again, the mysteries are embodied not just within a person, but within the tribe. It's an aspect of the tribe. And so that source tribe is the seed of the new race. It's not just the certain people are the seed, because the whole point is that we're all children of God. We're all creations of the spirit. The goal and destiny is for this, it's for the teachings of the Manu of that race to become embodied within humanity as a whole of this new cycle. So we're all destined to come to a state of realization that we are actually that Manu in meditation. We are all that spiritual source. And that this is all is actually a meditation of God that's happening. So there is no fundamentally separate persons or separate groups And the idea that one group should be pitted against another group is part of the illusion of materiality that's a function of the age that we live in. So anyway, going back to the book, it says the Lemurian migrations is a good establishes perhaps the archetype for what would happen in the Atlantean age and the Aryan age in terms of how races are specialized. So how does this source tribe let's go back to the Aryan example. How does this source tribe from India go from a state of unity to one that migrates out and splits up? And so it does so through migration, and through migration, there's a differentiation. So in time, due to migration and due to time periods and separating, so sort of generations from each different group who's branched out. Let's say one group of this original tribe goes east into China, one group goes west into Europe. 10 generations later, there will be almost no memory of the original source migration. Maybe there'll just be this idea that we all originated here, but the idea that there was another group that went the opposite way will have been lost. So then let's say that Europe, the tribe that went to Europe migrates, continues west and goes into the Americas. The one that went east goes even further east. Again, they find themselves in the Americas once you go around the world. So each goes halfway around the world and they meet up again. But when they meet up again, as we'll see here in this description, they meet up as total strangers. And there's a lack of memory because of the experiences that they all went through and how much time has passed. There's a loss of understanding at this point that both are actually part of one tribe. There was one source that both came from. But when they meet all this time later, and all these generations later, they see themselves as fundamentally separate tribes with separate stories and maybe even separate origins, or neither remembers that each had that common origin. So this is how the separation of tribes and the differentiation happens. So in time, each seems separate, but in reality, all are fundamentally linked. So groups separated by time and place adopt unique cultural patterns and physical characteristics. However, though differentiation takes place within the species, we remain always one humanity, one collective spiritual being expressing itself through the vehicle of human form. Humanity is thus like a tree. Though there are many branches, there is one common trunk and root system. So let's look at the early period and first migrations. The early Lemurians originated out of a region, this is according to Manly Hall / the esoteric teachings, because you'll see this similar dynamic in Blavatsky. I don't know enough about Steiner to say this, to know Rudolf Steiner to know whether this is exactly what he teaches, but the early Lemurians originate out of a region that is today occupied by the Gobi Desert in northern Asia. At that time, there was a great sea in that region. Now we're talking 60 to 10 million years ago, according to Manly Hall. The Lemurians first emerge and establish themselves in the fertile area along the shores of this sea that existed at the time. Changes in the climate gradually resulted in the erosion of habitability in this homeland region. As a result, waves of migrations gradually moved out and away from the source region in order to populate new locales throughout the world. And this would have been a very gradual motion, because he implies that the Lemurians were kind of like not only hunter-gatherers, but were very primitive, almost like Neanderthal types. For the duration of their long tenure on Earth, the Lemurians remained nomadic hunter-gatherers. Well, I guess he talks about it right here. Consequently, their tribal migrations largely followed the migrations of animals and the flowing of rivers and other bodies of water. So this next section is called Social and Psychological Differentiation. Over time, migrant groups would have lost connection with the memory of the source civilization. Consequently, these migrants would have developed unique customs, physical characteristics, and psychological attitudes specific to the places, climates, and experiences they would have encountered in their various migrations. When one of these migrating groups encountered another after some period of time, they would meet as total strangers. Neither knows or remembers anything of the other, and neither can perceive anything but the threat that each poses to one another. And this way, one race divides into various subraces. These subraces are not actually different races, but different branches of one human kingdom separated by time and place. Case study. Let's say a wave of migrants moved... This is kind of rehashing the American example I said. Let's say a wave of migrants moved eastward from the Pacific homeland, reaching the Americas. Meanwhile, another wave moves west through Eurasia across a great continental land bridge which once existed in the Atlantic Ocean and which is related to the Atlantean continent. Here in the Americas, the incoming migrants from Eurasia would have found a group of their own kind that had been existing and migrating throughout the Western Hemisphere, perhaps originating through the Asian stream. Thus, the two streams of identical origin after completing the circle had met again after the lapse of a vast amount of time. Time and space would have produced important differences between the two groups. Their migrations would have resulted in changes in their construction, appearance, and temperament. They who had started out as one nation met as strangers. There was no recognition of the fundamental identity of origin, and that was a Manly Hall quote right there. Thus, quote, change brought by the time element between migrations is the very basis of racial differentiation. So the time element between migrations and the direction element as well, and the climatic experiences that these different migrating groups would have gone through, perhaps differences in dietary base, these all go into modifying the phenotype, the appearances, the outward appearances and the cultural attributes, and perhaps would have modified how they expressed their institutions. But all would have shared a common design pattern, not only physical, mental, in terms of the individual form, but all still would have been based on a common institutional heritage that would have come from that source tribe. And by that, I mean the basic institutions of language and sort of governance, tribal authority. And you can have different expressions of these institutions, but the institutions themselves, the core categories, the core group social dynamics remain as much a part of us as the individual physical attributes. This is something that is probably going to take many videos for me to emphasize for people to become more knowing what I'm talking about, because before I ever studied esoteric philosophy, I spent a long time in the social sciences, particularly investigating the sociological concept of institutions. And institutions is as much a part of human psychology as the individual mind is. And sort of one of my great tasks, and this is something I go into in this new zine, is trying to link sociology and psychology. And in a lot of ways, there is a clear link between depth psychology's concept of the collective unconscious and institutions, because both have to do with a fundamentally collective aspect of human psychology. And institutions is something that people, it's sort of like a tower, one of those Tower of Babel concepts where there's a confusion of tongues, that people use the word in different ways. There's not a consistent meaning. So a lot of people will call something like the Federal Reserve an institution. Actually, that's an organization. The institutions are not things like that. They're patterns. They're large-scale, long-term psychological and behavioral patterns. And so we can think of those long-term patterns as being almost like an ecosystem, a psychological, a mental ecosystem that exists top-down over the individual. And that the individual coming up, so the cultural group perpetuates an institutional pattern. Like Western civilization, for example, exists as a set of mental patterns. And if you grow up in Western civilization, you become institutionalized to those patterns, meaning your own individual cognition becomes shaped and altered kind of top down by these patterns that are carried within the culture. And then you embody them. You act like a Westerner. you know, if you grow up in a tribal situation in, you know, sub-Saharan Africa or New Guinea or something like that, you're institutionalized to a different set of psychological and behavioral patterns that you embody in the course of your development. When you grow up, you're institutionalized to them. That's what, so they become a part of the way you cognize and make sense of the world. So that's what institutions do. So they set this cognitive backdrop for human activity and behavior. And so one of the things that they do is they affect the type of organizational patterns that that social group will manifest, the type of complexity. So in the West, we have an institutional system that allows for an incredible amount of complexity in terms of the type of organizations, patterns of organizations that humans are able to organize themselves into. It's much different in a tribal culture because everything's a lot simpler and things are a lot smaller on a lot smaller scale. So, you know, you'll have your tribal leaders and your warriors and your hunter-gatherers, and the sort of like the segmentations of society are fairly small. You know, you have your elders and your medicine priests, but the complexity is relatively small. There's not that many different sub-units or sub-organizations within the social system. In Western civilization, the social system is immense. There's, you know, billions of people involved all across the world in Western civilization. And so you have enormous complexity in the type of organizations are formed. And these organizations are formed at a hierarchy of scales. So you have the nation state as one type of organization at the upper end, or even at beyond that, you'll have like transnational type of things like you see with the European Union. Going down, you'll have economic zones, you'll have corporations, you know, you'll have local governments, you'll have community boards, school boards, things like that. These are different levels of organizational complexity that exist. But the thing that allows it all to sync together is this are these institutions. So an institution is not one organization or another. It's the overall large-scale psychological pattern. So to wrap up this overall conversation, having gone on a few tangents, the concept of race is a part-whole concept. And the fundamental reality that we all need to learn to identify with is the whole, the human race, the one life that we're all, no matter what ethnicity you are, we're all children of God. We're all individual expressions of that one life, that one spiritual consciousness. And all differentiation happens within the context of that oneness. And the oneness doesn't disappear just because there's differentiation and specialization. The oneness remains absolute. And so the differentiations are just enhanced complexity that's taking place. But it's always happening within the oneness, just as all the different things that are happening in place are always happening in the context of one space. Space is unified, and no matter where you go, from here to there, to there, to there, to there, you're always within space. So you can't ever get outside of space. So space is spirit. So if you can remember that, and keep that in mind, and also keep in mind the fact that there is a metaphysical reality that underlies individual material forms, and that metaphysical reality gradually is what connects us to abstract space, then you can set yourself up for understanding a lot of the underlying reality that exists behind what seems like a confusing, extremely complex world of pure individual forms. You can never find the solution by just focusing on the individual form. The solution can only come by moving beyond and within the form and looking at the psyche or the soul within the form and understanding that psyche or soul exists within these metaphysical dimensions I'm talking about. And that by exploring this inner world of psyche or soul, you finally connect to the consciousness of spirit. And that is the reality, the ultimate reality. And that spirit has to be allowed to become the ruler. And we have to self-consciously learn to participate and acknowledge the existence of the spiritual reality if we are to make the next step. And we are intended to make the next step, because this is the Aryan age. This is not the Atlantean age. We're not meant to have this fall. Ultimately, we went through that already. And we're going through the karma of it again, but we must learn the lessons that we did not learn before as Atlanteans. And that lesson is that the divine plan is absolute. This all exists as a meditation of God. There's no going against that. There's no mankind dominating nature, because nature is that absolute divine mind. And this whole situation with races and divide and conquer and all that stuff is playing out an Atlantean archetype. It's the old black magic of the Atlanteans, where people are, certain classes, in order to perpetuate self-interests, are caught up so deeply in the illusion of matter that they are, in the same way as the Atlantean priesthood had become caught up in the illusions of sort of spatio-temporal reality, that they move against the law, they move against the plan in order to fulfill their will rather than the divine will. And that's the great ignorance. And we're recapitulating that ignorance today on a global scale. But the solution can only be that we learn and overcome the lessons of the past. And I don't know how it'll play out exactly, but I know that things are not going to proceed in this sort of Atlantean archetype forever, because that's not the plan and that's not the age that we're in. So I hope this gives some context to the underlying philosophy of race and the sort of meaning and purpose of race, and how the philosophy of the whole situation is very different than what we are seeing kind of thrust upon the sort of mass psychology of the people through the media. I'll get into this in future videos, but there's definitely a Atlantean archetype, a sort of black magic archetype, a sort of mind control archetype of manipulating people in order to further political ends, economic ends, and sort of ideologies that are at root not grounded in an understanding of spiritual truth or law, but an understanding of, or really coming from people who I think don't have a foundation or a connection with spiritual reality or spiritual truth. And because they don't, they're trying to play God. Like, for example, you know, people like Bill Gates, or people like whoever's, you know, running at least a certain aspect of the national security state and the deep state, are people who, you know, for example, people who are obsessed with population control, you know, are people who don't believe that there's a meaning and purpose behind things, and so that they are putting it upon themselves to play God, to take control of this situation, to re-engineer things according to their vision and their understanding. So in some measure, I think that that's the driving element, is that type of ignorance. Because remember, in philosophy, the great evil is ignorance, superstition, and fear. I mean, yeah, the great evils are ignorance, superstition, and fear. And on some level, even if you're, I mean, you can definitely see those playing out today in the mass public, but in their own way, I think they play out among this class of people who are obsessed with sort of social engineering and population control and things like that. They are people who are trying to play God because they don't have a firm foundation in the philosophical truths of the world. So if I could contribute in some way to awakening people to those truths, then that's my goal. Anyway, thanks for tuning in. I'll have more coming up soon, and lots to do with depth psychology coming up. So thanks for tuning in.